Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Senate Ag Committee member and Georgia Democrat Raphael Warnock, who joins us to discuss the Farm Bill and providing help for disadvantaged farmers. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Black Sea Grain Initiative is on uncertain footing. Russia signaled a willingness earlier this week to grant a 60-day extension beyond the current March 18th renewal deadline. That's half the renewal period previously used by the UN, Ukraine, Russia, and Turkey. Russian officials have complained about restrictions on the country's fertilizer shipments. The deal is currently allowing millions of tons of Ukrainian wheat and corn to hit the global market. The latest consumer price index shows supermarket prices rose another 0.3% in February, a much lower rate of increase than the figures reported a year ago. Egg prices were down nearly 7% last month, while prices for beef, pork, fruits, vegetables, and bakery products all increased. The overall CPI rose by nearly 0.5% and is up 6% year over year. And finally, the nation's farm groups are asking for what they call sufficient budgetary resources in the next farm bill. Some 400 groups sent a letter to budget committee leaders on Capitol Hill this week, saying many recent events have tested the effectiveness of current farm policy. The letter also says funding is needed to address crop insurance, conservation, rural development, food security, and research priorities in the farm bill. Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock is a member of the Senate Ag Committee and the only Southeastern member among the panel's Democrats. He says balancing the needs of different interests will be a major challenge in the next farm bill.
I think it's my job as one of the two senators from Georgia to center the concerns of ordinary people, to deal with issues around commodities, to make sure our farmers are well positioned to do well. To succeed in a very tough business, tough market, and at the same time to secure nutritional and food security programs, our forestry industry. We can do all of these things. We can walk and chew gum at the same time.
So are you going to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, as you say, without adding additional money into the existing Farm Bill baseline?
It's early in the process, and I'm having robust conversations with my colleagues from the various regions. You know that a lot of these issues are regional and on both sides of the aisle. I think the issue is to center the concerns of ordinary people. And when we do that, I think we have a shot at getting the policy right.
One of the concerns that a number of people have brought up is whether or not, especially folks on the other side of the aisle, have brought up the concern of whether or not existing work requirements within the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program are sufficient. And even earlier this week, we saw legislation introduced that would address about 1.5 million people on that SNAP program. How do you go about assessing the existing work requirements structure within SNAP and any potential changes that might be pursued in this upcoming Farm Bill?
Well, I think when I think about something like the SNAP program, I think about a woman who wrote to my office. Her name was Nia, four children. She's disabled, by the way, and she's struggling. She's saying that the benefits that she gets now that are supposed to last an entire month only last 2 weeks. And it's really tough to tell your child that I don't have enough money to afford what you need to eat this month. So as we look at rising costs, clawing our way back from this pandemic, I think that there's a baseline of food security that we have to provide for people. We ought to encourage people to work. I'm not averse to that. But the truth of the matter is there are people who work every single day and are still dealing with basic food security issues. Again, I think we have to center the concerns of ordinary people and remember that most poor people who are struggling with food security are children.
One of the proposals you've pursued in regards to SNAP is whether or not an existing ban on people convicted of drug offenses should stay on the books. You're proposing lifting that ban. Why do you think it's the time to pursue such an action?
Listen, we went through, several decades draconian approach to the issues that people are dealing with around addiction. You're talking about returning citizens. And this idea that we single out this one issue and say, well, you can't get basic food security. We already know the outcomes of that. First of all, it's a moral issue for me. You know, I'm a Matthew 25 Christian, where Jesus said, I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked, you gave me clothes. I was in prison, you visited me. And they asked, well, when did this happen to you? Well, inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it also unto me. It's a moral issue for me. But beyond that, people returning from prison who are now trying to get their lives together, they already have a mark where they have to check that they've been convicted. And you want them to find work. And you provide, you deny them basic food security, even though they paid their debt to society. We know the outcome of that. It's higher recidivism rates. It doesn't help them and it doesn't help us. And it's way past time. Whether we're talking about urban people in some of our inner cities, people of color or poor white people in rural communities who are dealing with the opioid epidemic, we know more now than we did 40 years ago about addiction and how it works. And we can do better than that.
We'll be right back with more from Senator Warnock right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahe build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. Georgia's Raphael Warnock has been one of the most outspoken Democrats in the Senate on disadvantaged producer relief. But he tells us that's not the only piece of getting those producers the assistance they need.
Farming is a tough business. And I spent a lot of time from day one moving throughout our rural and agricultural community in Georgia, talking to farmers who deal with market volatility. They're dealing with climate. They're dealing with trade issues. And then you place historic discrimination on top of that, it's tough. So we have to provide debt relief, and I have been a leader on that score with providing debt relief to economically distressed farmers, but also dealing with those who deal with historic discrimination, while at the same time, yes, we have to provide training, which is why one of my priorities in the bill is to strengthen our 1890 universities and colleges. And to provide the kind of training that helps young farmers get into business.
So then with that in mind, you mentioned your priorities sort of for the upcoming Farm Bill, and we've seen action on distressed borrower relief in the recent Inflation Reduction Act. What do you think is left to be done on that issue and what could be done in the upcoming Farm Bill?
Well, we passed the legislation, and now we've just got to make sure that we get people the resources that they need, that this is happening. And so I will continue to hold USDA's feet to the fire. And we've seen the effects of that already. Some of this debt relief has already made its way out the door, but it can't move fast enough for me. And so I'll continue to push on that front.
Last Farm Bill passed with dang near 90 votes in the Senate. Obviously, bipartisanship is kind of a rare commodity in Washington these days. But in your conversations with your fellow senators, your conversations with agricultural groups, do you get the impression that there is that kind of appetite for that level of bipartisanship in this upcoming bill?
I think it's the only way to get things done, particularly now. We have a divided government, if you will, between Democrats and Republicans. And I think, look, solutions last longer when they're bipartisan. So I'm going to hold true to my values, the things that I think that are important. But I'm always looking forward to trying to find opportunities for bipartisan solutions because I think they last longer, and that's what I'll continue to do.
Senator, thanks for joining us.
Good to chat with you.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pegel walks us through an important part of the Farm Bill.
The first of the Farm Bill's 12 titles contains language authorizing commodity programs. This title covers price and income support for farmers who raise row crops. It also supports prices for dairy and sugar producers and provides agricultural disaster assistance. You might have heard of some of the most familiar programs under Title I, including price loss coverage, agriculture risk coverage, and marketing assistance loans. One big item to watch in the upcoming Title I debate is a possible increase in PLC reference prices, which trigger payments when commodity prices fall below a certain level. Many farm groups say input costs have gone up enough that higher reference prices are also needed. For example, USDA figures show the cost of corn production in 2022 was 87 cents per bushel higher than the reference price set into law. The current Farm Bill includes an escalator clause that could raise PLC reference prices, but some farm groups argue the support from that provision won't be enough. The fight will be expensive. A leading ag economist estimates a 10% increase could cost $20 billion over 10 years. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Who's replacing petroleum and asphalt? You are. Who mapped the soybean genome for better varieties? You did. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, it all comes back to your bottom line. That's you as your soy checkoff.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're going to continue our discussion on the efforts to aid disadvantaged farmers through farm policy with a panel of experts on the subject, joined this week by Dania Davey with the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, as well as Dwayne Goldman with the Department of Agriculture. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Dania, I want to go to you first because there's been a number of different assistance avenues pursued, including efforts to help with land access for disadvantaged farmers, minority producers in particular. For the uninitiated, someone that might not understand this issue, why is land access such a problem for this particular group of producers?
Well, there's a particularly complex history that I'm not sure that I have enough time to go into, stemming from a lot of systemic racial-based discrimination against African-American farmland owners in particular, which extended to other communities that have been historically underserved. And that resulted in a chilling effect on intergenerational incentives to stay on the land. So we have an issue of African-American land loss that's occurring, that's being exacerbated by that next generation that would naturally take over the ownership and the management of the farm, now being challenged when they're trying to access land to start farming businesses themselves.
Well, and part of the issue at play here as well is the heirs property issue, as you would know well. We've seen a number of efforts on this from a number of administrations. Congress has taken a swing at the issue a couple of times. Any progress being made?
Absolutely. Well, the 2018 Farm Bill, there was the Heir Property Relending Program that was authorized, and it took a few years for those regulations to be drafted. Last year, it was finally announced, and Farm Service Agency has been working with three intermediary lenders to make sure that heirs property landowners, those who inherited land without an estate plan, and so they have issues of tangled title, have access to the resources that they need to hire attorneys to make sure that those deeds are properly registered with their county offices, as well as to make sure that those families have access to resources to consolidate those interests. A lot of times there are lots of landowners that are legal heirs to a piece of property, and they have fractionated interests that need to be consolidated first before any of that legal work can be taken on. And FSA has really been working closely with us to make sure that there's a lot of technical assistance and outreach, not only to additional lenders to make sure that those those resources are widespread, but also to prospective borrowers that want to avail themselves of those loan funds to finally be able to have clear title to their land.
Well, and Dwayne, as we've just discussed with Dania, this is a multifaceted issue, very complex in its history, very complex in its potential solutions. But as we sit here right now, as we were just discussing, a lot of efforts have been undertaken to try and sort of bridge this gap. But as we sit here right now, how big does that gap remain between the disadvantaged producers where this assistance is being targeted and the other producers who perhaps are not being targeted for this assistance?
Well, I'll piggyback on Ms. Davies' comments and the fact that, that there's a history here of people being denied access. And I have to also remind us that we're talking about agriculture. And so when a person is denied access to certain benefits that allows them to capitalize their operations, it not only affects that person, it affects successive generations of folks. In some cases, it means a new profession. In other cases, it could mean that they stay on the farm, but they too are limited by the fact that they've been denied access. And so part of the challenge and the work that we're doing here at USDA now is really trying to address those cumulative impacts of that prior discrimination. Unfortunately, access to land and capital, those are kind of the first indications that that people have suffered from not having access. And if you look at a lot of the programs that we're trying to create, the heirs property program that we talked about, some of the other things that we're implementing through both the American Rescue Plan, the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as just the regular Farm Bill stuff, they're geared toward trying to address those barriers in a more meaningful way and make sure that we, you know, find a responsible way to account for those historical inadequacies.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Who increased sales to Egypt 700%? You did. Who's the number one protein in chicken feed? You are. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, it all comes back to your bottom line. That's you as your soy checkoff.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. The Biden administration's Department of Agriculture has been active on issues facing disadvantaged producers, and USDA's Dwayne Goldman says he wants the matter to have some staying power for future administrations as well.
I've spent several, even prior to coming to USDA, participated in several efforts where we're trying to provide recommendations that would help address some of these. But I do see a critical difference here. One is the fact that the Equity Commission this time was actually enabled by Congress, and which signals the importance of the work that we're trying to do. The other thing is it really is a panel of more integrated experts that not only look at the single piece of legislation perhaps, but also looks at how that's connected to making sure that agriculture as a whole is more equitable. And then I think the final piece is just the structure. The structure, the way that it's organized, you have an equity commission, you have two subcommittees where we get to drill down deeper into the recommendations into the situation and develop recommendations that really provide a more in-depth discussion of the things that we need to do to address the discrepancies, the disparities that are there, but also working with the equity commission and being a conduit between the commission and the department to see how we can put those things in USDA so that they are more permanent, more sustainable, so that as we go from one administration to the next, that those things will become part of the fabric versus a single movement that can easily be taken away.
Much of the work of the Equity Commission over the course of the last year has been soliciting feedback and drafting this list of interim recommendations, drafting a report that it has been now delivered to the Department of Agriculture. As one of the new co-chairs of that commission, I have to ask, what is there on the commission's agenda at this point with that report now done, with those recommendations submitted to the department?
So you've seen the report, and it's labeled interim report. There's an English version and a Spanish version, and it's labeled interim reports. So if you look at it, it's divided into a couple of key subject areas that have emerged as areas that we need to address. But there are some issues in there that, quite honestly, haven't been resolved yet. So if you look at crop acreage basis, for instance, the county committee, there are certain issues in there that will require the Equity Commission to have more of a dialogue with USDA to understand those issues so that they can make a more actionable recommendation.
So we talked quite a bit about things that are happening at the USDA level. Let's wrap up our conversation by taking things to Capitol Hill. And Danielle, that's where I want to bring you back into the fold here. Obviously, as you and every other viewer of this program well knows, Congress in the process of drafting the next farm bill. I do wonder what's kind of on your wish list as it relates to minority and disadvantaged producer issues in the upcoming farm bill?
A lot of our priorities are directly connected to access to credit and making sure that Black farmers don't get left out of that picture, making sure that any ways in which racial equity is discussed, that we're making sure that that doesn't leave Black farmers at the end of that list, but they're also considered with their unique history and what's been documented around the ways in which they, to this day, you know, as recently as this week, spoke to some farmers down in Louisiana that are being challenged in accessing credit. They're better situated than others, and so they wouldn't be a good fit for Farm Service Agency, but trying to get other agricultural lenders in their community to treat them with the rights of citizenship is still a challenge. And so in addition to our farm bill advocacy work, which we're primarily focused on training our members to do that for themselves through our advocacy institute, we continue to do our work of providing technical assistance and outreach to those farmers that continue to face those barriers in their communities.
So much has been done and much remains yet to be done on this subject and some of the tangential subjects around it. Certainly a fascinating conversation. And Danya and Duane, we appreciate you joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Lydia Johnson has a report on ag research spending in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Lawmakers are gearing up to write the next farm bill, and many in agriculture hope the legislation will address a 20-year decline in research funding. This chart shows inflation-adjusted USDA data for public investment on ag research and development in the U.S. As you can see, spending has declined by about one-third since peak contributions in 2002. At the same time, ag research funding has increased annually in China, the European Union, India, and Brazil. China alone has quintupled its funding since 2005. The U.S. federal government funds about two-thirds of public ag research. The remainder comes from state governments and non-government sources. Land-grant universities and non-federal institutions perform about 70% of public ag research. USDA's Economic Research Service suggests present trends could affect the U.S.'s role as a global leader in agricultural sciences. It could also impact global trade competitiveness if production does not keep pace with other countries. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson.
Don't miss the must-attend policy event of the year. Register now for the 2023 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear from the diverse players who are trying to influence legislation and investment decisions as we examine the forward-looking ideas that will drive policy discussions for this year and the decades ahead. The summit takes place on March 20th at the National Press Club in Washington and through our virtual experience. View the agenda and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. Our AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit is Monday. Join us at the National Press Club or virtually. On Capitol Hill, we'll be keeping our eyes on a Wednesday hearing with the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee and a Thursday get-together at the House Ag Appropriations Subcommittee. As always, we'll have the latest on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.